Talking to Paul Copan, and he is a contributor to the Christian Research Journal. And just one more reason to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. You can do that online at equip.org, or when you speak to our resource consultants at 888-7000-CRI. You can also order via the mail at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins believes that we have an extraordinary predisposition towards believing in God because we are, and these are his words, not mine, infected with mental viruses. And one of those viruses is believing in God. Is this one of the reasons that you felt compelled to write an article for the Christian Research Journal on this subject?
Well, you know, this is an area that's really interested me, and I've written some, a little bit on this, and when I was asked to do a full-blown piece on it, I said, yeah, this sounds great, and because this is something that really does perplex a lot of people. It's something, a lot of bestsellers, a lot of popular-selling books have come out that, that talk about God and the brain, the God gene, and so forth, and they are often propounding this idea that, well, yeah, we're hardwired to believe in God, and they often just leave it at that, that this is something that is inbuilt into us that simply enhances survival. But, you know, the idea of a God outside the brain, well, that's, you know, neither here nor there. That's a lot of people consider it irrelevant, or some people consider it a decisive argument against the existence of God, which I still can't figure out. But it is a remarkable tide in naturalistic, philosophy of mind, in neurophysiology and so forth. There is very much this reductionistic approach to reducing all religious experiences, all, even the mental, soulish capacities that human beings have, just down to the physical.
Paul, tell me how schools have changed in the 21st century. What are your students like, and how different are they than they might have been a generation ago?
Well, that's a great question. I think that we are seeing, I think just a different disposition with regard to, I think, biblical understanding, biblical literacy. I think people are coming with a far less comprehensive grasp of the scriptures. I think it's often piecemeal. We have, in a sense, moved away from the moorings of a Judeo-Christian understanding of things. The Christian worldview does not seem to have a strong hold on people's thinking. In fact, the criticism that often comes from outside the church walls is that people who are within the church are hypocritical, boring and irrelevant, judgmental. They're basically just out to talk to people about Jesus, and if they're not interested in Jesus, then those Christians aren't interested in those people as friends. And Christians are often seen as too political, that they think that they've just got to have their political candidate in office or else all is lost, rather than seeing the church as being God's instrument of change and cultural transformation and so forth. So I think there are a lot of legitimate criticisms, and I think that part of this whole ethos, both within and outside of the church, there's a certain sense of almost jadedness to the significance and the significance of the and the role of the church within society, that it seems that there is a great marginalization that has taken place, and that there are the common language is no longer of the Bible and Christian theology, but it is more along the lines of celebrities, people who are making a lot of money, people who are perhaps a political icon here or there, but it seems like the influence has been lost. And that I think that as you come into the classroom, you sense that there is not just an ignorance, but even a strong disregard for, say, the Word of God. There is a lack of moral bearing or understanding. It's a much more relativistic society than it was a generation ago. People have that mindset of, well, that's just true for you, or that's just right for you, but not for me. It's not just students who are coming in who have this mindset, but a lot of teachers themselves who are proclaiming this. A recent study a few years ago from the National Association of Scholars and Zogby International said that about three-quarters of the students in universities today said that their professors didn't believe that there are any objective standards for right and wrong, that it's just a matter of individual or cultural preference. So those are startling changes.
One of the things that I've mentioned on the Bible Answer Man broadcast is Professor Bart Ehrman. He's a professor, is the chair of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he's written a book titled Misquoting Jesus. He's got a new book coming out, and in that book he is chronicling his reluctant trek from being a fundamentalist Christian to an agnostic. And he says it is because he finally saw that the Bible is not reliable. And as I look at his arguments, and I was dealing with one just the other day, it seems to me that he simply never learned to read the Bible for all it's worth. So he comes to the parable of the mustard seed, and he says Jesus was obviously wrong with respect to the parable of the mustard seed, saying that the mustard seed is the smallest of all seeds, and the Bible has to be fallible in that Mark records this parable. And orchid seeds are obviously smaller than mustard seeds, and therefore you find a mistake. And if he had learned to consider genre or form, he would have never come to that decision. Now, as related to you, how many times do you run into these kinds of questions? Because in the university, kids who can't necessarily, at that particular point in time, think with discernment, fall for the argument and run off from the Christian faith because, in their view, the Christian faith is irrational in an age of scientific enlightenment.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's kind of funny. I was just talking about Bart Ehrman in class this morning, and I saw him actually was participating in a forum with him and several others at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. So it was good to interact with him and to hear more directly some of the things that that he's been talking about. And it's interesting. And I think that, you know, somebody who responded to him, Dan Wallace. By the way, he's written some excellent. He teaches at Dallas Theological Seminary. He's a textual critic himself, and just offers a couple of articles online. Like one of them is called "The Gospel According to Bart," and a couple of shorter articles as well. But in those articles, he points out how some of the statements that that Bart Ehrman seems to make are misleading. There are some statements that he makes about just Christian theology, like there's a text in 1 John 5, 7, and 8, which was a later insertion about the doctrine of the Trinity, which, again, biblical scholars don't take as a justification for the doctrine of the Trinity. They find that throughout the New Testament, throughout the Scriptures, as being well justified and strongly implied. But Bart Ehrman says, well, look, you know, if you don't, he acts as though, he gives the impression that if you don't have this text in there, well, the whole doctrine of the Trinity falls apart, and that can be very misleading. Or, you know, just again, other things that he says about the textual reliability of the Scriptures, it seems that he is making very strong claims, but again, people who know about those passages and those textual issues are utterly unmoved by that because they recognize that they aren't the crucial issues that Bart Ehrman makes them out to be. It's not as though this somehow changes the doctrine of the New Testament or something like that. So you're right, there are a lot of people who can be misled. In fact, Dan Wallace made the point, although Bart Ehrman disagreed, but in his popular writings, Bart Ehrman tends to be much more sensationalistic, I think the term that Dan used, when he is writing to a popular audience, but he's much more reserved, much more conservative when he's writing to a scholarly audience. And so he gave a number of quotations at this forum that seemed to bear that out, although again, Bart Ehrman denied that he was being inconsistent, but it did strike me that way, that there was this inconsistency in how he's presenting it. But it is a big issue, and it's certainly one that we need to keep tabs on.
You write under the column philosophical apologetics that is certainly a mouthful. Can you give us a little perspective on what philosophical apologetics is and why it is so crucially important today?
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, a lot of times people will ask me, you know, I'd really like to go into apologetics, and I'll say, well, that's great, that's a great discipline, but what is often helpful is if you have a background in philosophy that can help to inform your understanding of apologetics, that it's not just giving, factual arguments that will support, say, the resurrection of Jesus, but it's good to have an overarching approach, say, as to what is involved in the concept of miracle, why some of the philosophical arguments against miracles are inadequate, and how they fall short. And so to have a philosophical grasp of some of these issues, rather than just knowing some of the factual points, say, about why so-and-so is wrong about the resurrection, it's good just to have a broader, overarching concept of the philosophical issues that need to be grasped, which makes, I think, the task of apologetics a lot more, I think, rich and meaningful, that we can actually engage at yet another level rather than simply doing maybe piecemeal arguments or, I'd say, more surface arguments that really perhaps haven't grasped the deeper philosophical implications.
What's the import of your book, and why do you relate your new book to Starbucks?
Well, one of the things that I've tried to do in three previous books, one is called True for You But Not for Me, the other one is called That's Just Your Interpretation, another one is called How Do You Know You're Not Wrong, and then there's this fourth one in the series, When God Goes to Starbucks, and then I've written a kind of a general philosophy of religion book called Loving Wisdom that has a similar approach. But what I try to do is make certain important philosophical, theological, apologetical issues more accessible to people. I think a lot of people can get lost in some of the philosophical wanderings of people in my discipline, but what I'm trying to do is bring some of these arguments home to people so that they can maybe think through more clearly some of the assumptions behind slogans that they commonly hear, such as, you know, who are you to impose your moral values on others? Well, when you think about it, you realize, wow, there's actually a person who believes that it's morally wrong to impose his moral values. Wow, that's actually a moral standard that he's holding to. Now, where does that standard come from? Or when a person says, you know, who are you to judge others? Well, it's good to ask questions like, well, what do you mean by judging? Give me a definition of that, because that often helps clarify what that person means, and a lot of times it will expose certain inconsistencies in the definitions and assumptions that people have, and what they actually are doing is they're often making themselves the exception to their own rules. When they say you're judging someone, what they typically define it as is that you're saying that someone else is wrong, but of course they don't think past that to the recognition that they are saying that you are wrong for saying that someone else is wrong. And so what I'm trying to do is help people to go a little deeper in a kind of a step-by-step way, and I try to make these, addressing these slogans a bit more accessible. And I try to, again, reach into the world of where a lot of people are, the conversations that they have at the water coolers and over lunch with their colleagues, and I try to address some of the slogans, some of the, indeed, tough issues. I talk about, you know, well, what about slavery in the Bible? What about the killing of the Canaanites? Is that like Islamic jihad? Or, you know, isn't God just a psychological crutch? Or, you know, if God made the universe, who made God? Isn't God being three and one contradictory? You know, well, if Jesus was God, how could he be tempted? What about reincarnation or pantheism? So I'm trying to help people in a step-by-step way think through these issues. And then, you know, at the end of my chapters, I typically have, you know, bullet points that summarize the discussion. I give resources for further reading and so forth. So I do want to make some of these perhaps loftier or maybe seemingly inaccessible or obscure concepts that people will often bring up, and Christians often don't know how to handle it. I want to help Christians and even non-Christians to be able to think through these issues more clearly.
Talking to Paul Copan, and he is a contributor to the Christian Research Journal. And just one more reason to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal, you can do that online at equip.org, or when you speak to our resource consultants at 888-7000-CRI. You can also order via the mail at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Paul, when's your book coming out?
The book should be out in July or August.
And we would love to have you back on the show then.
Would love to be on with you. Thank you.
Hey, Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Hank, as always. Great.
God bless you.